From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I talk with actress and author Shirley MacLaine. In recent years, she's become known not just for her acting, but for her investigations into psychic phenomena. Also today, I talk with retired Army Colonel Joe Conmee. He was technical advisor for the movie Hamburger Hill, helping recreate a Vietnam battle he helped command. On the anniversary of the death of Maria Callas, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new home videos featuring her performances on German television. And guest commentator Jan Harald Brunvand explains the etymology and entomology of the earwig. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is actress Shirley MacLaine. She's well known for her roles in over 30 films, from her debut performance in Alfred Hitchcock's The Trouble with Harry, to her roles in Some Came Running, The Apartment, Sweet Charity, Being There, The Turning Point, and her Academy Award-winning performance in Terms of Endearment. Today, MacLaine is perhaps even better known for her spiritual beliefs, which she has presented in books, on television, and in workshops. She wrote and played herself in a TV miniseries based on her book Out on a Limb, which was about her spiritual search. Her new book tells about the making of that miniseries. It's titled It's All in the Playing, and it's just been published by Bantam Books. Shirley MacLaine, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Are you getting a lot of scripts now from movie producers with roles for psychics and spiritual questers?
Mm-hmm. And most of the scripts are not very good because, you know, to make a metaphysical script work, you have to have the involvement of the characters in something the audience can identify with, like someone's personal search or someone wants to contact a dead relative and the way to do it would be thus and such. And so the audience can identify with the pursuit and it has a first, second, and third act. Most of those scripts are very esoteric and what we'd call expositionary in terms of the material. So they're not involving. They're not dramatic.
Are there any scripts that you think you're not getting sent because of your spiritual beliefs?
Oh, no. Oh, no, Terry. The opposite.
So mm-hmm. I was wondering if any producers might think, well, she's too identified with flaky religious beliefs and we won't send her this.
No, I think it would be the opposite. They think I've inherited a new audience. I mean, there's people out there buying my books and stuff that don't even know I'm a movie star. And I find that fascinating. I noticed that when I was doing my one-woman show, I inherited so many young people who had no idea that I had been in films. They had read my books and then wanted to see me on the stage.
Are you going to keep acting?
Oh, yes. I'm doing a picture now.
What's the movie?
It's called Madame Suzatska. It's for John Schlesinger. And I'm in it with Peggy Ashcroft, and Twiggy plays a young girl in it. It's a very epic character. It's a kind of a small picture, somewhere between Room with a View and Terms of Endearment, somewhere right in the middle there. Well, I love the part. It's the first part that I've loved enough to commit myself to play in. Since I made Terms of Endearment.
Is that why you haven't done more movies recently, yeah. Because you haven't liked the roles?
I've liked the parts, but I haven't liked the movies. And I like to be in a movie that means something, or at least explore some kind of humanity.
Since deciding to go public about your spiritual beliefs in reincarnation and trans-channeling on out-of-body experiences, you've become something of a guru in your own right. A lot of people attend your workshops and, mm-hmm. and are reading your books about spirituality. And I wonder if you think that there are certain hazards in that. And let me explain. Mm-hmm. Here's what I'm thinking. People so much want to be like the celebrities that they admire and to be close with them. There's lifestyles of the rich and famous. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's becoming a spiritual equivalent, spirituality of the rich and famous, in which people seek out a certain spirituality because their favorite celebrity is following it.
Oh, that's a different question than what do I think of this perception that I'm a guru? Well, anyway, there's two separate questions there. The one, I am not comfortable myself with being a person who is a guide for someone else's own developing spirituality. They're their own best guide. Maybe I'm a catalyst. Maybe I just sort of strike the flint and light a little spark, and then they light their own way. Whether because I'm a celebrity, I would think it would work in the opposite direction. It took a long time to earn this. Because I was a celebrity, I think people at first wondered, well, what does this mean? Because this is a very profound subject, and perhaps because I went so far out on a limb, so to speak, and risked my entire 30-year career, put it on the line, and nothing really happened to me. But they saw me do it, and they saw me stick with it, and they saw me not only not back off, but go further out on the limb. Maybe I earned my spiritual stripes. But I don't think that's got anything to do with being a celebrity, except insofar as I did risk my entire career and nothing bad happened to me. So if nothing bad happened to me, nothing bad would happen to someone else, presumably, who would also expose themselves in public.
I guess it was a risk for you to go public, and I'm sure a lot of people urged you not to do it. Mm-hmm. But even early in your career, you had a reputation for being kooky. That's the word that was always used, mm-hmm. kooky to describe you, or mm-hmm. impish, elfish. What did you do to earn that reputation early in your career?
Oh, you know, if the studio would say, we think you should go, because I was one of the last contract players, we think you should go to a premiere with such and such a man and get out of the car, and if they make gossip about it, that's fine, it would help the picture. I said, well, wait a minute, I don't want to do that. And besides, I don't even want to see this movie that I just made. I would do things like go to the premiere by myself, sneak in, change my clothes, and leave. Something like that would make me kooky. I was independent. I was living my life the way I saw it to be led. I was never a follower. I didn't believe in the phony sort of tinsel panache that they thought would engender people to be interested in me. I wasn't interested in them if that was what I had to do. And that earned me the reputation of being, I think, just unorthodox is really what it is.
Was there a studio publicist who resisted you every step of the way?
No. No, I did notice early on that as long as I was very strong and very centered about the fact that I wasn't going to participate in that kind of stuff, people are sensitive to that, and then they don't suggest it anymore. You know, I always used to think something was wrong with me that nobody ever tried to put me on a casting couch. I thought maybe I wasn't attractive. But nobody ever did. And it was because I never expected it. It was because it just didn't occur to me that they were going to.
It's interesting. You think you give off whether you're available or not.
Exactly. And they knew I was definite. No man likes to be humiliated, particularly in front of his secretary, so they didn't even try.
You started off your career in Chorus Lines on Broadway. Did you ever get to the point of feeling, I just want out, I've had enough of the Chorus Line?
Yeah. That was what was going on the very night that Carol Haney twisted her ankle and I went home. Well, she twisted it in the afternoon performance. I didn't think it was that bad an injury. I went home and in between, I discussed with my husband, I'm going to turn in my notice and I'm going to turn it in tonight because that woman will go on with a broken neck. And what am I doing in the chorus? I've been offered the understudy for Gwen Verdon in Can Can, and I had my notice in my pocket to turn into Hal Prince and Bob Fosse when I arrived at the theater that night, and they said Haney was out and I was on.
It's a real 42nd Street
kind of story.
And that's how you first became noticed, starring in Pajama Game, replacing Carol Haney. Mm-hmm. The first movie role you had was in The Trouble with Harry, and you were directed by Alfred Hitchcock. And to have your movie debut be directed by such an important
director who didn't even like actors, that was the interesting part.
Well, I've heard that, but I'm not really sure what that means. Did you feel he didn't like actors when you worked with him?
Oh, he thought we were irrelevant. Oh, absolutely. He was very nice, but he was more interested in where he could take us to lunch to try the newest creme fraiche or something like that. What was important to him was the script in the first preview. What went on the soundstage was irrelevant. And by the way, he had it all up on a board. You could see any of Hitch's pictures by just looking at the pictures he had on a board, the still shots, the drawings. The cameraman knew exactly what was going to happen. The crew knew what was going to happen. As long as we just didn't bump into the furniture and said the right lines, it didn't matter because the script was it.
Does this mean he didn't give you any advice on your performance?
Well, let me tell you the advice that he used to give me. He never said a word in terms of good acting, but he walked up to me, actually, on the first day and said, now, before you say that word, dog's feet. And I didn't know that this was Cockney slang. Would you know what to do if someone said, before you say that word, dog's feet? What are dog's feet?
Besides the feet of dogs, I have no idea.
They're paws. So he said, before you say that word, paws.
That's pretty cryptic.
Rather cryptic. And, you know, I was floundering around in my dancer's naivete, wondering, is this what great acting is all about, trying to figure out Cockney slang? He got kind of a very mischievous, almost bordering on sadistic kick out of it.
In one of your books, you wrote that you gained 25 pounds during the making of the movie. Mm-hmm. I'd seen the movie. I saw it 3 years ago or something. I don't remember noticing that.
Because I'm very big. You know, I'm 5'7". And when I gain weight, I gain it equally. So I just, you don't see where it goes. But, you know, there's a little something different about me. I come plowing into a room instead of gracefully walking into a room when I've gained that much weight. But you wouldn't see me fat. You would just see me substantially different.
You were trained as a dancer and started off in Broadway musicals. Were you glad when your first movie was a comedy drama as opposed to a musical? Did you want to get out of musicals?
No, I loved musicals. I never even thought of Hollywood. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to act. I knew how to dance and a little bit how to sing, but I was basically a dancer. I didn't even have time to think when it all happened.
My guest is actress Shirley MacLaine, who has, by the way, just written a book based on the making of, it's about the making of her TV miniseries Out on a Limb, and the book is called It's All in the Playing. Another early one of your movies, Some Came Running, it's a really interesting film. I saw it for the first time just a few months ago on television, and you star in it with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, mm-hmm. and it's directed by Vincent Minnelli, who mostly directed musicals in his career. So here you are, a woman with two of the big men in the Rat Pack, mm-hmm. and this is, I think, the early days.
It was actually
the
Klan.
It was the Klan, then?
The Klan. Humphrey Bogart and those fellows were the Rat Pack. The Klan was another group. Oh, boy.
Well, what was it like being the woman with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin when you were off the set?
Well, I was the one that they liked my talent, I think, and they were protective. I mean, a man would not have been able to come on to me if I had wanted him to, because they were there sort of as the bulwark for my virginity or something. They taught me little tricks about comedy on the stage, and we would go to Las Vegas, and they'd put me up on the stage and teach me things, and then I would try them out, and they would work. I remember when the script to Some Came Running came through, and Dave, the character that Frank plays in the Jimmy Jones original book, is the one who got shot. But Frank said, no, I want this kid to get nominated. We got to kill her, not me. You know, very generous about his shrewdness in how to throw the sympathy to the character that would best benefit for it. It was like that. It was an appreciation of professional talent. And I was sort of a mascot. I would bring them chocolates and flowers and just be around like a pet is sort of what I was.
Your character is shot in the movie, mm-hmm. as you just mentioned. Was that the first time that you had to
die
in a film?
Yeah.
Did that take an emotional toll at all?
No. My God. I was just trying to find my mark and not turn my ankle. and to the scene that followed that, when Frank had to do some kind of acting over my body, it was hard for me not to breathe. It's hard for me not to laugh.
So no big emotional thing there?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Shirley MacLaine is my guest, and a little later we're going to talk about her spiritual beliefs. She's written a book based on the making of her miniseries, Out on a Limb, and the book is called It's All in the Playing. And we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Shirley MacLaine is my guest. You once wrote that when you became a star, you realized you had power. And once you realized you had power, you had to figure out what was the right way to use it. Mm-hmm. What should you do with it? So what are some of the things when you had that realization that you decided to do with the power you had?
At the same time that I had that realization, I think I was developing my social consciousness, and it really ticked me off that people would abuse the power they had. So it sort of dovetailed with my own developing recognizance of my own power. I was always interested in being professional. I think I came out of the womb being professional. Of course, I'm a dancer, so I'm very disciplined about that. That's the only power I liked to insist on, was insisting that other people try to live up to their own capacity for professionalism. But I guess as I started to travel, my compassion for the underdog developed, and my questions about human injustice became more and more profound. And as a result of the socio-political realizations I had in traveling and in my work with the feminist movement and some of the political candidates that I worked for, I'm probably taking too quantum a leap here, but I began to examine my own values more and more thoroughly until I came to the big question, why is all of this happening? And that's what got me into the spiritual search.
You made the movie based on your book, Out on a Limb, mm-hmm. about your spiritual search. And you shot some of it in Peru. An interesting thing happened in Peru that you describe in your book, which is that the Peruvians in the cast weren't getting any food this part. They weren't getting free food along with the rest of the American cast, I guess because they were officially extras. And you complained and said, how can we be making a movie about spiritualism and be treating people like we're the ugly Americans? Mm-hmm. This seems to be happening a lot in movies that are set in third world countries now.
Yeah.
This kind of problem.
Yes, on the other hand, I've been hearing these horror stories filter back from Donald Sutherland's picture in China on Bethune, where the crew doesn't have any food, and the actors don't have any food, and the stars don't have any food, and Donald himself lost like 35 pounds. And I don't know why it's all happening. I mean, that's where you really come to a question of, let's have some explanations here.
You played yourself in the movie Out on a Limb, which is perhaps your strangest role, playing yourself. And you've written that life was becoming like a play to me. Mm-hmm. Was it hard to play yourself? Because you weren't just being you. You had to act there.
Yeah. I liked the character, number one. And I knew her. I knew how she thinks and how she moves and how she acts. And real knowledge of a character is what occurs in between the lines that are written in the script. So I was very conversant with her. Now, I say her because I was playing me 10 years ago, which is equivalent to another her. I mean, I'm not like that anymore. Part of it was difficult because there's some things that in my skepticism I had to act out, and I could feel the audience see me acting. Because they knew that I was no longer that skeptical, but in the beginning I was. That was difficult.
In acting yourself, I don't know. I want to get to an episode that you talk about in the movie that I don't know what to make of. You're in. This is your role as the movie maker too. You're in Machu Picchu, which is in Peru.
Right.
It's one of the ancient ruins where, mm-hmm. where you're shooting. And everything's almost done with the movie, but you have a few shots to make, and you want to take some stills also there.
Have a whole day of shooting, yeah.
Okay, and it's going to rain. Mm-hmm. You feel like it's
going to
rain.
It is raining.
Okay, but, mm-hmm. but you can't allow it to rain because it's going to ruin the shooting. Mm-hmm. So you use all of your energy to hold back the rain?
No, what happened was I went to a bruja. The Peruvians said, you've come in the rainy season. It's going to cost you a lot of money. You have to ask the gods of the Andes if they will allow sun to shine in the rainy season at Machu Picchu, and we'll find you a bruja. That's what they call them. So this spiritual guide, Andean bruja, came into my trailer, and we did a session where he contacted the gods, he claimed, and got permission. And those Andean protectors and gods got in touch with my guides and said, all right, we will allow it to be sunny if you contribute to the visualization of the sun. And so they gave me a whole ceremony to do, which was to face the east and imagine the kind of weather I wanted. Now, it wasn't just me. It was me and Stan Margulies, the producer, and my assistant, and another woman who was responsible for my meeting the bruja. And it was absolutely raining cats and dogs, as they say, when we arrived in Machu Picchu. And the crew thought, because this is the second time we had tried to get it, and they thought, this is never going to happen. To make a long story short, I climbed up the steps with the other three. We went into a visualization in the middle of the rain and burned the twigs and did all the things that he told us to do. And within about 2 hours, the clouds had cleared. And the shot that we got, the light that we got, was not flat sunlight, but the kind of sunlight we actually visualized, which was third dimensional, so that you could see clouds and filtering through light and beautiful shadows. It was an extraordinary experience. Now, I don't know, maybe it's coincidence, but as I describe it in the book, of course, it's much more complicated, and the toll that it took on me in terms of the exertion of the kind of visualization energy, it was hard, and I got sick.
From the energy that you used to make it separate. Mm-hmm. You know, some people who are skeptics think that you're popularizing of out-of-body experiences and trans-channeling are trivializing spirituality by making it into a kind of fairy tale type of thing where one person can have the energy to accomplish magical things, where miracles can be performed on a daily basis.
But everybody can. That's the whole point, is to popularize it, so that you can see you can do it too. That's the whole point. It's not exclusive or elitist. I mean, this is what Jesus said, too. You will do what I have done and greater. So the popularization of spirituality is indeed the whole point. Become a spiritual being. Use your positive power. Use your positive approach to loving yourself. Improve your life and the life of others.
The people who are trying to emulate your particular kind of spirituality don't have one advantage that you do, which is the kind of mobility and money that you have. In other words, so that you could travel to see an acupuncturist and a trans channeler and all the different religious and spiritual specialists that you have.
That doesn't cost much money. Besides, oh, most people say that, well, you just, you know, drive 2 hours to some place. Mm-hmm. They're all over the place. Most people feel that to find this kind of spirituality, you need to give up everything. It's the opposite. And down through the ages, to take a vow of poverty is to find enlightenment. That's usually what people think. So to say, well, I could do it because I had money, as a matter of fact, it's become more complicated. But that's all right, because, you know, to analyze the role that money and materialism plays in one's own spiritual search is very fascinating. Like with my seminars, I would much prefer to have done those seminars for nothing. But if I threw the doors open to, and there wasn't any, but it's like the same theory with anything. Everybody would have come just to see a movie star, and I wanted people who were really committed and serious students of these metaphysical techniques. So I was on the low end of the scale in terms of what weekend seminars go for, and then, of course, I'm going to spend all the money on my spiritual center.
Do you find that on in movies that you make now that there are different people in different religious camps? I was reading about when you were making Terms of Endearment, for instance, and I guess you were involved in the beginnings of your spiritual quest, and Deborah Winger was into Gurdjieff. Mm-hmm. I'm just imagining that behind the scenes, everybody's got their own personal thing going.
Yeah, I think so. And everyone has their own thread to unravel, because everybody has a different ball of wax. Sure, everybody's reality is different. Yeah.
Let's talk about acting a little more. When you're acting with someone who has a different way of getting into the role, mm-hmm. that you do, does that cause conflicts on screen or off screen? For instance, some people like to follow through on a role off screen and remain almost in persona, and other people think that that's ridiculous to do, and that when the camera stops, you're not in the role anymore.
Well, that's up to them, as long as they don't knock on my door at 4:00 in the morning playing the part that they're playing in the movie. If they want to keep in character all night long, 24 hours a day, fine. I might do that in the next film I'm making, this one I just described with Schlesinger. I might do that because I love this character, and she's so epic. And I think the environment in which we're going to shoot this will be positive enough for me to try it. I've never really done that. I'm one of those kind of professional, stable people who after 6:00 says, okay, that's it, I'm going home to my personal life. But I might try being Suzatska 24 hours a day. I'd like to try that, because it's all going to happen in London, where I'm away from my own home, local environmental stimuli, and I might just do it. I'm looking forward to trying that. And if I like it, by the way, then I'll write about that.
Do you still treat your body like a dancer's body?
Yeah, I do my yoga every day. And I am still addicted to food, like all dancers. I still...
You get addicted because you have to starve yourself.
No, it's some other psychological trip that we do on ourselves. It's got to do with we would love to be thin. Audrey Hepburn is fat in terms of what we'd like to be. And yet at the same time, we are totally hung up on junk food. I just love junk food. Well, when I say junk food, I don't go and eat hamburgers and have shakes, but a hot fudge sundae or sweets, I'm very, very involved with. I mean, I'm trying to work that out, but it's still a problem for me.
You turned 50, I believe, not too long ago?
No, 53.
53, okay. Mm-hmm. Are you comfortable about aging, and are you comfortable about getting older in front of the camera? And we only have a few seconds left here.
That's why I love this character I'm playing. She has to look like an old 55. And I don't have to worry. It's just a wonderful feeling.
So you're glad to look, to be able to look your age or even a little older on camera instead of having to cover.
No, I'm looking forward to that. And the woman I'm going to play after this is 79.
Really? Well, that'll be a stretch.
I've made a leap into character acting now.
Shirley MacLaine, I want to thank you very much for being here. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been actress Shirley MacLaine, and she's written a new book about the making of the miniseries Out on a Limb, and the new book is called It's All in the Playing. It's published by Bantam Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Leanne Hansen will guest host the next edition of Fresh Air. Her guest will be former Watergate special prosecutor Archibald Cox. So hope you can be with us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with retired Army Colonel Joe Conmee. While serving in Vietnam, Conmee was a commander in the Battle of Hamburger Hill. He helped recreate that battle for the new movie Hamburger Hill. Also, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new performance videos that offer rare glimpses of diva Maria Callas. And commentator Jan Harald Brunvand traces how people got so afraid of the lowly earwig. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. The soprano Maria Callas died of a heart attack 10 years ago at her home in Paris when she was 53. Callas was known both on and off stage as a dramatic and powerful personality. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of two new video cassettes of Callas' performances on German television, recorded more than 25 years ago.
Tragically, there is no visual record of Maria Callas in a complete operatic role. There is, of course, an endless array of photographs of her in almost every part she played, and they are among the most expressive theatrical pictures ever taken. Her face and body were extraordinarily mobile and full of conviction. Looking at her wringing her hands in the second act of La Traviata is like watching a great silent movie. But actual moving pictures of her are much rarer. Two of her Tosca performances were televised, but only the second act, the famous scene in which the tormented diva sings Vici d'arte, I lived for art, and then stabs her tormentor, Scarpia. Pirated copies of both have turned up, in poor quality, but they're terrifyingly intense. Some video rental stores have Franco Zeffirelli's excellent TV documentary about Callas, which includes some additional footage of her. And now the Kultur Video Company has put out cassettes of Callas recitals telecast in Hamburg, Germany in 1959 and 1962. They are thrilling documents. In the 1962 concert, she's on stage while the orchestra is playing the overture to Carmen, and we actually see her turning into Carmen long before she begins the habanera. The very structure of her face seems to change. In her Carmen, a role she never sang in the opera house, the clue to her character is her smile. It's a sexy smile, but it's even more ironic than sexual. She has learned the lesson that love is just a rebellious bird. If you want it, it flies away. If you don't, it comes after you. It's in her blood. The hand on her hip isn't just the stock stage gesture. It's a gesture of defiance. You think I'm wrong? Well, prove it. Both contemptuous and resigned.
Thank you.
Callas singing Carmen in a live concert televised in Hamburg in 1962, conducted by Georges Prêtre. The selections on the video cassette include arias from Massenet's Le Cid, Rossini's La Cenerentola, Cinderella, Verdi's Ernani, and an amazing performance of the self-tormented Princess Eboli's O Don Fatale from Verdi's Don Carlo. Amazingly, she never performed any of these roles in the opera house, and she never made a complete recording of any of them except Carmen. In the 1959 recital, under Nicola Recinio, she's an even stronger, more secure voice. She sings five arias, including Tu che le vanità, another great tragic aria from Don Carlo, but by a very different character. And she gives a dazzling comic performance of Rosina's Una voce poco fa from The Barber of Seville. The tapes are beautifully engineered, the TV picture is astonishingly clear, and the sound for television is excellent. Beware of defects in the tape soundtrack, though. I had to get replacement copies for both tapes.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed two video cassettes of Maria Callas performances from Kultur Video. This is Fresh Air. Colonel Joseph Conmee retired from the Army in 1973 and recently found a new career in the movies. He's consulted on two films about the war in Vietnam, Gardens of Stone, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and the new film Hamburger Hill. Conmee was a brigade commander at the Battle of Hamburger Hill, leading the 101st Airborne Division on 11 assaults while 1 million pounds of bombs dropped overhead. Early on in the making of the movie version of the battle, Conmee was hired as a technical advisor.
I was called to Hollywood with whatever documents I had about the battle, and I sat down at the conference table with the producer and the director and the writer, and we went over in detail my knowledge of the battle, checking it against what they knew, and we altered what they had based on my information. From that point then, I was used to review the script and to come up with any recommended changes. Again, they were principally time and place changes, a couple of major things, but nothing of any major significance. From that point then, they needed someone to go into the Pentagon and process the script so that we could obtain Department of Defense support for the film.
What kind of support were you looking for from the Department of
Defense? We were looking for aircraft. We were looking for use of facilities in the armed forces, facilities in the Philippines. We needed fighter aircraft. We needed helicopters of various sorts. We needed extras from Subic Bay and from Clark Field. And although they're Navy and Marine installations, we put them in Army uniforms, and they had to take leave to be extras.
You were a career military man. Do you see any parallels between the military and movie making?
I see very close parallel. I found the production staff, the positions on it, very similar to the positions you find in a military staff. You could take just about everyone from the director, the producer, the director, on down through all of the different jobs and give them a title based on a military staff.
Can we talk about the real battle that the movie's based on?
Yes.
What was the hill that you had to try to take over?
Well, the hill was in a place in Vietnam called the A Chau Valley. Now, the A Chau Valley was the western border of the northern part of South Vietnam. And this valley, for years, had been an enemy stronghold. And they used this area to launch attacks against the coastal towns and villages and cities, generally from the town of Hue down to Da Nang. And the Tet Offensive, which was the major offensive which occurred in 1968, was launched from this area into the Wei and Da Nang region.
How many days did the battle last?
The battle lasted 10 days.
Where were you exactly as the commander, as a commander during that battle?
If I wasn't on the ground dealing with my subordinate commanders, I was in a helicopter a couple hundred feet above the battle, directing artillery fire, bringing in airstrikes, and coordinating the activities of the unit making the actual attack.
What are some of your most vivid memories of the battle?
There are two things, really three things. The tenacity of the enemy. The North Vietnamese were a determined, well-trained enemy. The second thing is, on the 15th of May, 1969, we were very close to victory, and our own gunships mistakenly took our troops for the enemy and strafed them, and we had several casualties, and it knocked us back, and we lost the ground that we had taken earlier. Again, on the 18th of May, we again very nearly took the hill when one of the most vicious tropical rainstorms hit the area that I have ever seen in my life. It turned the hill into a mudslide, and the troops lost their footing, and it slid down the hill and again lost this terrain which they'd fought so hard to take.
In the movie, I think you're left with the feeling at the end that although the American troops won the battle, that it was hard to tell what the point of the battle was.
Well, the point of the battle was to take the terrain away from the enemy and deny him the use of this area, the Ashau Valley, from that point forward, and where we did lose some American lives in this battle, and no commander wants to lose anybody. In the long run, we saved thousands of lives in the Vietnamese South Vietnamese population, which is the reason we were over there, to enable them to renew life and to start over and to rebuild a life for themselves.
How did the hill that you took get named Hamburger Hill?
Well, the hill's name and Vietnamese name was Dong Ap Bia, but about midway through the battle, one of the soldiers said, "This place ought to be named Hamburger Hill." And the word spread, and the name stuck.
Let's get back to your role as technical advisor for the movie Hamburger Hill. It's really a very graphic war movie where you see mutilated bodies and opened wounds with guts spilling out. Did you personally want the movie to show graphic scenes on the battlefield?
Yes, I did. I wanted the people in this country to know what it was like to fight a battle in war. And I felt the previous films on Vietnam didn't demonstrate what our troops really did over there. It presented them, and I think it defamed them in a lot of cases, where this film showed the hardships that they went through and that they persevered and really achieved something that they were trying to achieve and not were just not pot-smoking psychos who killed women and children and, worst of all, murdered each other.
Were you on the set?
Yes, I was on the set from start to finish.
When the movie was being made, was it very realistic to you? Did it really make you feel like the battle was being fought again?
Not particularly then, because, as you know, you reshoot a scene a dozen times frequently. But the first time I saw it on the screen, that's when it really hit me. I couldn't talk when it was over.
What reaction do you think you would have had to Hamburger Hill if you were a young man seeing that movie? A young man who, say, 15 or 16, who hadn't fought in a war but might someday?
I think I would have been shocked to see the real thing. Up to that point, I'd probably seen these things where some hero seems to whip the enemy by himself, And that sort of thing just doesn't happen in real combat.
I think one person can go see the movie and think that war requires such bravery and is so noble that they would gladly go to battle if their country called them, and that somebody else could see that same movie and come out with the message that war was absurd and not worth risking one's life for, and would become a conscientious objector.
Well, I've been a professional soldier all my life, and I know that there's nothing good about war. Unfortunately, they keep happening, and it was my profession to fight them if they came up. However, I don't think there's anything grandiose about them. It does take courage to go and do the job, and I've seen, I commanded American men in World War II and in Korea and in Vietnam, and I never had an American boy quit on me. They hated the hell out of it, and who wouldn't? All you have to do is look at Hamburger Hill to see how tough it is. But they did the job. I never had them stop.
I guess you were thinking about those boys a lot when you made the movie.
Absolutely.
Well, Colonel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Colonel Joseph Conmee was a technical advisor for the film Hamburger Hill. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
It's the second day of confirmation hearings for Judge Bork.
That's right, and we'll be hearing a report on, among other things, the questioning of the nominee to the Supreme Court about his role in what's gone down as the Saturday Night Massacre, the firing of Special Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox, which took place during the Nixon administration. Also, we'll have a report on the Pope's trip in Los Angeles today. Pope John Paul II met with American bishops and was very critical of some of the arguments he's been hearing from American Catholics.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jan Harald Brunvand joins us today as a new commentator on Fresh Air. Jan collects urban legends, those stories that are passed along by word of mouth, which no one can ever really substantiate. Today he explores a common tale about earwigs, those little bugs with pincer-like appendages.
The proverbial expression to put a bug in your ear, meaning to implant an idea in your mind, is said to originate from the belief that earwigs creep into people's ears. Although earwigs seldom creep into people's ears, their popular name, plus an urban legend, perpetuate that fear. In the usual story, a woman is lying on a beach when a little earwig slips into her ear and crawls straight ahead as far as possible. The Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, that Bible of every word watcher, traces the word earwig, meaning ear insect, back to Old English and Middle English prototypes that looks sort of like the modern name as it might be spelled by someone with an insect buzzing in his ear, earwigon, aorwiga, and so forth. The OED dates the name of the insect, as well as, quote, the notion that it penetrates into the head through the ear, to at least the year 1000. Sometimes I have a notion to ask people who still believe in ear-entering earwigs if they have ever really experienced anything like this, or known anyone who has, or even known anyone who knew anyone else who has. The next part of the earwig story is the hardest to swallow. Listen to this. Supposedly, a doctor examines the poor young woman with the earwig lodged in her ear and says, he's too far in to grab. We'll just have to let him work his way through and come out the other side. Her doctor makes one big error in this diagnosis by saying him, for when the insect does emerge from the other ear, he's a she. Then the doc explains grimly, I'm afraid this female earwig may have laid eggs in your head, and if so, they'll hatch and eventually eat out your brain. The other assumption behind this wild story is that medical students take entomology courses in college just so they will be able to distinguish male from female earwigs. To return to the metaphorical bug in your ear, the OED also records the verb to earwig going back to 1837, meaning to pester, influence, or bias a person by insinuating yourself like an earwig into his confidence. Which brings me to a recent manifestation of the legend in popular culture. In Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, a big film hit a few years back, the villainous Khan, you remember this, insinuates space creatures into the ears of two Starship Enterprise officers in order to make them subservient to his commands. In the summer of 1982, when this Star Trek flick was the rage, a newspaper editor in Boise, Idaho, remembered an 11-year-old local news item about an earwig. The editor revived the story from the paper's back file and put a replay of it on the AP wire as a sort of footnote to the Star Trek film. It's the one case I found of an earwig actually entering someone's ear. That someone was Janet Ward of Boise, who back in 1971, when the Boise area had been infested with earwigs, consulted her doctor about an intense earache. Using forceps, the doctor extracted what the news story reports as an earwig from her ear. Okay, so an earwig can enter an ear. I'll admit that much. But a place has to be pretty darn earwiggy, in fact, positively smothering in earwigginess, to support such a thing happening. I found those wonderful words, earwiggy and earwigginess, listed in the OED, but not used since the 1870s. Let me put this bug in your ear. How about introducing both words back into current usage? But don't believe the story about female earwigs laying eggs in someone's head. That's just another urban legend.
Jan Harald Brunvand is a professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. His latest collection of urban legends, The Mexican Pet, is published by Norton. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, guest host Leanne Hansen speaks with actor Danny Glover. He's best known for his roles in Lethal Weapon, Places in the Heart, and The Color Purple. He plays Nelson Mandela in an upcoming HBO special. Rock critic Ken Tucker will review a new album by guitarist Tom Verlaine. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Fatal Attraction, starring Michael Douglas and Glenn Close. It's about a one-night stand that evolves into a nightmarish obsession. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.